Sometimes you just got to begin to chase a dream that is bigger than you. Sometimes when it seems like you're so far behind, you'll never catch up. You got to get up on your feet. You can't wait on other people to be what you've been called to be.
Hello and welcome to the Ugly Daughter Podcast. This is Julia Legian. Today, I'll be talking to a really interesting lady. Her name is Sophia Wiseman. She is a fun and radical lady. She has been called a modern-day medicine woman. She's a teacher, author, entrepreneur, speaker, and has been a facilitator and healer since she was a teenager. She has had thousands of people finding and loving their authentic self. Soul unification, she called it. Hello, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Sophia, can you tell us a bit about your background?
Yes, absolutely. So my background consists mostly of blessings. I feel really, really gifted and lucky and privileged and blessed. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at home, the youngest of three. We were all home births. And I was born into a family. The story goes that as soon as I could talk, I told them that before I was born, God called me into a room and showed me two pictures and said, where do you want to go? And I looked at a family of my mom and dad and my brother and sister, and I said, send me there. They need my help. And I think a lot of children are born into this world sharing tidbits about before this incarnation or before this experience, this life, whatever you want to call it. I'm not attached necessarily to how you describe kind of previous or before, but the difference in my upbringing is that I was believed and those stories were treasured. And so they were told back to me. And I think that's a big part of my story is that I grew up in a household that really listened and kept some of that wisdom that children have intact. And I was really gifted. I went to some really great progressive schools when I was a little kid, really rooted in liberatory pedagogy. For those people that don't know what pedagogy is, pedagogy is how you educate. It's like the goal of your education. And I was educated in really kind of freeing, critical thinking, engaging, compassionate-based schooling. And my mom has an MFA in theater and is a yoga teacher, has been a yoga teacher my whole life. My father, a clinical psychologist. And so really kind of grew up in an environment of like, how are you feeling? What do you think about that? Really engaging. I also grew up going to church every Sunday. I went to a really progressive Episcopal church that I loved because especially as a kid, it was one of the few places that I could go and talk about my love of God, my love of angels, my understanding of things where I felt really accepted and it didn't feel so weird. So church was a really safe place for me because my church was also really rooted in progressive theology and really about embracing love and in a material way. Like, how do you actually manifest real love? And then throughout this time, all of these things are true. My mother, very early on in my life, sometime between 2 and 3, I think, my mom became chronically ill with chronic fatigue syndrome. And at the time in the 80s, that wasn't a real diagnosis. And so the only place she could get help was alternative medicines, shamans, acupuncture, massage, you know, energy work, all of these things were the only places she could get herbalists, she could get support. So very early on in my life, I was exposed to these other things, again, as practices, sanctuaries. By the time I was an early teen, my sister also got sick with chronic fatigue. And I was very much the caretaker of my family, even though I was the youngest. And that's a really common story, I think, for people that are really sensitive and, you know, and caretaking at a very, very young age. And although that was hard and heartbreaking and had a lot of grief and a lot of anger that I didn't know was anger, so much anger, but you don't know it's anger because you just do what you got to do. You just have to do what you got to do. But my whole family unit was, you know, everyone did the best they could. But whatever you could do, you did. And all of us have a lot of gifts and are really good hearts. And so we all did what we could. And part of my job was a lot of emotional tracking and kind of taking care of people, and then also having that bleed into just kind of logistics of things, like not only taking care of my mom in little ways, but also when my sister was sick, because my dad was working and my mom was sick, and then I was taking care of my sister in ways. So I really developed a lot of skills that were like highly intuitive. All those little gifts that I had got really heightened as a coping mechanism. So anticipating, I usually can tell when people are going to get sick, like a really bad sickness, within about before 3 days before anybody knows. And then the other, I did a lot of theater. So theater is also a lot about reading people and body language and communicating kind of through multiple layers. So then I deepened my training and sensitivity and listening and communicating my own stuff. I also was in therapy as a child, you know, so I also learned my own processing then. I started going to this summer camp that's a live action role playing. So live action role playing or LARPing. I went to a LARPing camp, it's like Lord of the Rings, but with foam weapons running around in the woods. And ours was really based on cooperative play and improv theater. So not a heavy like game system, point system, really into cooperation, expression, creativity, a lot of mask work, a lot of singing and playing and movement and myth. And that is actually one of my strongest learning grounds, places where I learned for shamanism or working between the worlds, because I would play and it would get me out of my like ego, especially because I was got me out of an ego because it got me into another ego, got me into another identity. So I would be, and I would get, after years of playing, I would get typecast as like the moon goddess and the fairy queen and the healer and the cleric. And like, so I played these characters over and over again where I would kind of summon and shift and bridge these worlds. And when I went to college, I had a total mental breakdown. And I think a lot of that happened because I was so inside my world as a child and a teen. And when I left and got some perspective, I started to process more. I fell in love. And when I went to college, the person I fell in love with left my sophomore year. And when they left, it awakened all of that abandonment, sadness, anger that I had felt kind of my whole life and didn't have space for. And so my junior year of college, I dropped out of college and started picking up odd jobs and did a lot of crying, went to a lot of therapy, and really prayed really hard because I had enough foundation to know that my grief and my breakdown was a door opening, but I had to work with it if I wanted to change it. So I got diagnosed with PMDD, which is premenstrual disorder. And that's kind of the worst days of PMS, but extended, like not just 1 or 2 days, a week before, a week during. So half of every month I was really struggling. And so I really used all the things that I had learned before, all this intuitive, all this everything, to really dig deep and pray hard and listen a lot and give up a lot of ideas that I had, a lot of constructs. I gave up a lot of my new age kind of jargon in a lot of ways. I went through a whole phase where I was like, I don't know what I believe. I don't know what's happening. Like, I'm just going to scratch it all, just start from the beginning, and just did a lot of kind of going down to the basics. And during that time, I went and got trained as a massage therapist. Over the years, I went back and finished my BA and got a BA in health arts and sciences and play and healing, and did a long-term apprenticeship and became a Reiki master teacher. And all this time, I also was now running that same LARPing summer camp. So during the summer, I would still spend my summers. And sometimes during the year, I did a lot of after-school programs and things like that, really rooted in theater and all of these things. So it's really a combination of all of these different aspects of everything that kind of has brought me through. One of the big things for me for healing my PMDD was I really had to get clear on my menstrual cycle and then my whole hormonal cycle. I did a lot of calendaring, and I found that a lot, even down to when I would get hiccups every month, was totally clockwork. And I mapped it all out. I saw that my mania and my grief and my anger would come through. So at first I was just managing myself. I like knew it was coming and I would just manage it. And then at one point I stopped managing and started accepting. I was like, what if I just accept this is what's happening? And so instead of looking at my rage that happened as a problem I had to get through, it was as much as a gift as the mania. And so I would be like, I'm not angry about nothing. I just need to, so I don't need to shut myself up. I need to listen. And so instead of everything being about getting through the hard parts, everything, the highs, the lows, the neutrality was about listening to what aspect of myself is trying to share itself. So my body has been a major tool for me to show me things that are sometimes hard to look at. I wasn't good at ignoring my rage or my exhaustion because my body, it was beyond my control. I know a lot of people who could control it, and I was blessed that I didn't have that kind of control. It didn't feel like that at the time. It felt like a curse that how come everybody else could just manage and I couldn't manage. I would just, you know, weep 5 times a day for years.
I had been in your shoes. I'm still weeping, actually.
Yeah. Oh, weep, sister, weep. It's okay. It's really okay. Those tears, you know, every tear is a blessing. One of the things I often say to myself and sometimes to other people is, it's all blessed, even if it doesn't feel blessed. You know, like it doesn't have to feel good to have it be holy, to have it be sacred. Our suffering is part of the sacred experience of being here and being in form. And my heart goes to you in your time of weeping. That's real. You know, I mean, that's not fun. It's a sad, weeping time and space to be in. And I was in that space for about 5 to 7 years. It was a long time. I didn't know if it was going to end. And at a certain point, I realized it didn't matter. I was just going to have to do every day, whatever way I could. I still have moments now where I back and I think like that time was so, I didn't know I would be where I am now. I didn't know that I would have on a regular basis, a quiet and a calm and a peace and a happiness that I have. I don't think anyone could have I thought everyone was lying a little bit.
I think we all do.
About happiness, you know what I mean? And it's like my happiness. And I think the thing is that I don't know if people said to me, which is like, my happiness comes with all the same suffering. Like I still get sad. I still hate myself. I still get anxious. But while I'm anxious and while I'm sad, I feel like a peace or a comfort. The phrase that I often think about is like, keeping company, that there's like a part of me that is loving and keeps the part of me that is hurting company, you know? And it's like that loving company is the thing that I have. I'm not going to say 100% of the time, but I'm getting closer and closer. And the amount of time that I forget that I have that loving company is getting smaller and smaller. And I stopped waiting to die, you know? Like it was a little bit, as a spiritual person, there was a little bit of like, I'll just get through this life. Like I just want to go home, you know?
It's like, funny you mentioned that. I say it to my husband all the time. I truly can't wait to go home.
That's right. Totally. I get it. I really just wanted to go home. And I would get these deep meditations or receive these deep healings. And I'd wake up and I'd be like, I'm still here. Like, fine. You know, I was really bummed about it. Really, for a long time. I get it. I totally get it. And then something shifted for me. And I really have this sense now that my time here is precious, you know, and it's not a theoretical precious anymore. I've really feel that way. Like I feel like even if I live till I'm 100, you know, that's like less than 70 years now. And like, that's not a long time. That's just like a blip.
I agree, Sophia, that time is precious, but I think it's okay to long to go home. Somehow I have this strong belief that there is something wonderful waiting for all of us on the other side. And so I'm really looking forward to return home.
Right. Totally, totally, totally. I am looking forward to it still. It's like it's a good destination. I feel good about it. But I used to feel much more like I'd rather be there than here. And that feels like it's softened some. And, when people ask me, how'd I do that? Cause I have a couple of friends that don't have the same spiritual belief that you and I, they don't even have a sense of going home. They just have a sense of wanting out.
That's
of being
sad.
Human. Yeah, that's that. Right. Exactly. That's even sadder. So a couple of them were like, how'd you get there? And I said, diligence every day, every moment. I track, am I keeping myself company with kindness, or am I living with a bully? And I lived with a bully inside. Every feeling, every sadness, every anger, every disappointment, every failure was that inside voice would take as a chance to say like, you suck. You suck again.
You're going to suck every day.
I didn't get rid of the bully. I just made the compassionate, kind voice louder. So that even when that voice that says you suck, I have another voice that says, says, oh, you really feel like you suck today. I get that. You're feeling really shitty about yourself. I get it. You hate yourself. Get it. I get it. We all hate ourselves. Like, that's the stronger voice in me, is this essence of like, and I did that with interruption, with EFT, a practice that I loved using, daily meditations, journaling. One of my favorite things to do actually as a practice is when I'm journaling or talking out loud. It doesn't work as well in my head silently. I used to think it did, but I have to externalize it, is that I'll write things and then I'll say nasty rhetorical questions like, who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing? Why are you going to do this? What I started doing was answering the questions in literal ways. Like, I lead these women's circles sometimes. I lead healing circles sometimes with women. And I remember this one circle that I was in, and I'm in this circle and everybody's deep in meditation, and I'm sitting there and my head, I'm going like, oh my God, what are you doing? Like, you're an idiot. No one here wants to be here. You're like fooling everybody. Like, this is a waste of time. I'm like sitting there. I'm supposed to be holding this sacred space, and this voice is just going off like an alarm in my head. So I pull out my journal and I write this question, like, what do you think you're doing right here? And I just answered it. And I was like, I'm sitting in a room with people that I care about because I believe that they can feel more peace. I am inviting them to remember things. I'm telling them that they're lovable. Like, I just listed all the things that I was doing. I was like, I'm wishing, I'm hoping, I'm making space, I'm breathing. And then it was like the end of it. And I was like, oh, that's okay. Like, that's an okay way to spend your time, you know? Like, so one of my favorite things to do is to ask those nasty voices, when those nasty voices say things, to actually engage with them, but not in a fighting way, in like a, whatever that question is, to just answer it. Like, who do you think you are? I think my name is Sophia. I'm born in Philadelphia. I've been given a lot of gifts and a lot of education that a lot of people haven't. I do my best to create a culture and a world that has less violence in it. It's like, oh, it's like, I think my part is very little, but it's the part that I have. That's who I think I am. Like, that's what it is. Like, is that enough? Yeah. Like, ego, yeah. Is that enough for me to be worthy of taking up space or breathing air? And one of the things I also, for me, that's really helpful has been recognizing colonialism and patriarchy and the cultural hunt on self-love. You know, that we've really been bullied out of trusting ourselves. And the activist in me has been empowered by knowing that. It's not our nature to necessarily obsessively hate ourselves and want to disappear. That we were convinced that we needed to disappear. That when we stood up and we were wise, when we shared our medicine, when we had ownership over our bodies and our sexuality, when we thought we were valuable, we were harder to control.
It's true what you said. You know, once you allow the bully to reside in your head, it's really difficult to get rid of it. I really love your perspective. It's very different from anything I have ever heard before. Make peace with your bully and don't try to fight with it is a wonderful recommendation, Sophia.
Well, yeah, it's beautiful, because I think if you realize that bully voice is a fear voice a lot of the time, and that it's often a fear child voice. If you recognize that it's a child, then I like to think about how, I like to think if a little kid came into a room, right? You're sitting in a room and a little kid comes in and they're like, and you're like, what? I think about that voice in my head that either is actually upset or that mean voice. I often think about like getting down on my knees and saying like, what's happening? What's happening? You look really distressed, and like slowing it way down, because that part of me that freaked out, or I think freaked out's a good way. It encompasses a lot, like whatever that is, really angry, really sad, really upset, really scared. That freaked out kid is going very fast. And so it's like the job of the adult to like slow down and to care, to just care and just be like, what is happening, sweetie? And it's amazing how many people inside their head treat their 2-year-old, their 4-year-old, their 6-year-old, their 10-year-old, who just doesn't know what's happening and is trying to figure out what's happening as best they can, which is with like limited processing ability. I was gonna say, it's amazing how many people really beat up on that little kid. And you know, I've done inner child work since I was a child, literally. My like 9-year-old went back to visit my 4-year-old. Now in meditation, expectations. What I've learned as an adult is that it's really important if you're a kid to not take a kid back to your kid, because you just have a bunch of kids taking care of things. If you're going to spiritually, you got to take the kid to go get their wise future version of themselves and bring them back to their little kid. So you can still do inner child work with 9-year-olds, but you have to take them to their like grown ass 30-year-old and get them back energetically. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Sophia, I believe when something dramatic happened to you at a young age, apparently your emotion will be trapped at that space in time.
Yeah.
So although physically you grow and look older, but really you're still trapped in a child's in a child mentality.
Right.
And subconsciously you go through life and you make your decision based on a frightened child instead of as a young and responsible adult.
Right.
And I was not aware of my behavior until my husband brought it to my attention. So how do you make people aware and help them deal with this kind of challenge, Sophia?
Yeah, it's important. I think, you know, I try from a bunch of different angles. You know, I think one of the things, some people hate the language inner child. They think it's like so stupid and so, they can't handle this idea of inner child. So when they can't handle the inner child image, I often talk about, I take the approach of that we didn't learn the skills that we need to be an adult. And so I talk about it as skill building, adulting, right? So if someone's really resistant, we just talk about adulting. We just talk about like, well, do you know how to take care of yourself when you get really sad? Well, no, I just don't get sad. And I'm like, well, that's a skill adult has, actually. So nobody taught you that. And that's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but it's okay. But now you get to learn that skill because now you know that it's a skill that adults, grown people have. They know how to be with intense emotions. They don't avoid them. That's something that anxious people without skills. So I talk about it in terms of skills or no skills is one way that I talk about it that's not kind of inner child related. If people are open to the inner child stuff, I still talk about it like skills, but you can often, most people, once they have that awareness, their intuition can actually build, I would say, about 60%, like over half of the skills that we didn't. Like our intuition is there because you think about how you want to navigate somebody else's kid, right? Or your kid, and you think, well, no, you don't throw something at a kid who's crying, you know? Like that's not what you do. And then you realize, oh, but that's what I've been doing. I tell this story. I have a story of my inner child work that I did about, I guess this is when after I dropped out of college, I was in massage school. I went to massage school in that time and I was had this meditation. And I went and I found this inner child and she was about maybe 6 or 7 and she was bloody. I mean, she was bloody and bruised and she was hiding in a corner and I saw her and I was furious and I started to walk towards her and I was like, who did this to you? I'm going to destroy them. Like you are lovable. What happened? And she pulled away from me and I stopped and I was like, oh my God. And I looked around and I saw that next to me was a pile of bricks. And in this vision, I saw that what I had done every time that inner child had come towards me with a request, I'd thrown a brick at her and she was bruised and she was bloody. And I looked and I saw her and I saw the bricks and I got down on my knees and I was like, I am so sorry. Like I had no idea. I didn't even know I was doing this. And I spent the next few months on a regular basis recognizing that I had to build my own trust again. And so this is one of those skills where I realized the way to build trust is to not apologize and say, I'm sorry, but to apologize and say, I recognize that I did these things and I recognize that these things hurt. And I am saying, I won't do those things again. And I will do my best to hear you the first time. And I began having this very long process of just letting her know that I had to go back many times and not throw bricks. And it was this recognition of like, I had been unconsciously there throwing bricks. And when I showed up consciously, even though I had been doing this, I was like, this is insane. This is not what you do. Like, this is not what you do. Like, you don't do this. And what I ended up doing is she trusted me. Then I got to tend her wounds. I cleaned the bloody parts. I put balms on. Then she'd sit on my lap and I'd ask her, tell me stories. Sometimes she'd tell me stories. She'd tell me about times that I did it. And this is when it would shift from metaphor into literal, right? She would say like, when you used to hang out with this person and they would call you stupid and they would say mean things and they'd touch you in ways you didn't like. Like, I wanted you to leave, but you ignored me, right? Like, these very literal, it was like, and so I started to have these very literal conversations with this, the part of myself that had these boundaries. And what I realized is that my little kid isn't just throwing tantrums most of the time. She has a request. She has a need that she is trying to get heard and trying to protect me.
Yeah. So you and I have the ability to tune into our energy and to talk to our future self or past. But there are many people who do not have this kind of gift. And also let me tell you right now that there will be plenty of skeptics listening to this interview. So how can you help our listeners, and what do you want to say to the skeptics?
Right. Skeptics. Great. I love skeptics. I love them. I really do. I do a lot of work with people. I've worked with a lot of people. And I think it's mostly because something about when you know me in person and things like that, that I have kind of a gruff Philly edge, you know, like I curse a lot. I'm like, yeah, I love your it, but I like curse a lot and I'm queer. Exactly. It's like, just, I'm a rule breaker. Like it's not a thing, you know, but so skeptics are really important to the conversation because actually, truth be told, my partner and I talk about this. I am also a skeptic. And I used to not believe in possession. I was like, possession doesn't make sense to me. That's weird. That's some crazy shit. Then I was in a session with someone. I had a really intense experience, didn't quite know what to put into words. At the end of it, the person told me what happened that matched my experience. And I was like, well, it's a good thing that I don't need to believe in something for it to be real. Because they, you know, released something that wasn't them and I didn't have to believe in it. So one of the things for skeptics, or if you're a skeptic out there, is that the good news is we don't have to believe in gravity for gravity to be real. We don't have to understand physics for planes to work. But we do, if we want to use those things to our advantage, it behooves us to engage in them, right? So it's like, there's this aspect of you don't need to believe, don't believe me, don't believe Julia, don't believe us. Literally, I'm inviting you to test what we are saying. Test it. Sit down. Don't put music on. Put music on. Sit down. Lock a door so nobody bothers you. And sit down with a paper and pen and say, do a question and answer with yourself. And just give yourself permission to see what happens. Even if it's like the, so write a question that's like, let's see. Let's start with like, is there a part of me? Am I lacking skills as an adult? Start there. Am I lacking skills as an adult? Are there things that I'd want to know more? Just answer that question, you know, and answer it with whatever comes, with a yes, no, or more. It's like, I mean, for the most part, I'm pretty good, but, you know, whatever. Are you totally, completely satisfied with the emotional relationships in your life? The first part of this work is to, like, get honest. That's what I'm asking people to do, like, get honest. So it's like, ask these questions. It's like, how do you feel in your emotional life? Are you satisfied? And then here's another question. Have you ever gotten feedback that you were not emotionally receptive or engaging? Has anyone ever told you that? Just do that. And it's like, okay, now if there's anything in there that says there might be some room to grow, accept that. Look at that. That's one of the, that's how I got here, is that I've taken feedback. Like I was talking about that negative voice. I take that feedback as maybe there's something there. Maybe I probably don't need to be bullied over it, but there might be a gem in there. That negative voice is smart. It usually uses a partial truth to beat us up and make us feel bad about ourselves. So the trick is to listen to that partial truth. So you ask these questions and then you say, okay, then if you really are having an honest conversation with yourself, you can say, do I have an inner child? Next question can be, is there a part of me that I have not been paying attention to? And then the next question is, what is that part of me trying to show me or tell me? And then you can, this is what I'm saying, test it. Do it first writing, because what I've seen is that people don't give themselves the space. They assume it won't work. So the first thing is test it. Just test it. Do this. That's the first thing. Test it. If you do it and it totally doesn't work, that's information. Okay, cool. Doesn't work. Now, these are the things that they're skills that you develop over time having this conversation with yourself. But most people are always having conversations with themselves, right? Every day. We're constantly having conversations. Skeptics have conversations with themselves all the time. I say something and they say in their head, she's full of some bullshit. Right?
Yeah.
All the time, right? We're having those conversations. So what I'm asking skeptics to do is, you don't have, your inner voice doesn't have to agree with me. I want you to just get honest with what your inner voice is saying. Most skeptics' inner voices are A, asking really good questions, and B, being nasty to them. If you can just get through those two pieces and breathe, then no matter what you get, even if you don't get some deep spiritual insight, you'll have more insight than you had before. And I think insight listening to yourself is the most important part. I don't need people to be intuitively reading, talking to their spirit guide. That's not it. But if you can at least get transparent with those voices, and it's amazing. My mom and I were just talking about this last night. She was talking about a friend of hers who says that they read to their kid every night. Oh, we read to our kid every night. And she said, they don't read to their kid every night. Like, I know that actually, like I've seen that, but they tell themselves they do that. And I was like, well, we all do that, right? We all tell ourselves that we do one thing and then don't really do another. And it's tricky. Now, if you're really bold, if you're a skeptic and you really want to test yourself here, you take those answers. This is where it's like, you take those answers that you asked with yourself. You sit down with someone who really loves you, really trusts you, and you share those answers and you ask them for feedback. You get feedback because this, and it doesn't, they don't have to be right. It's not about them being right. It's not about you being right. It's about breaking these notions that the conversations we're having in our head are the absolute truth. And most skeptics have decided what the truth is, and then they live their life that way. What I'll say is that I'm a skeptic. That's always, my mind is always being blown by science, by my experience. And I give myself permission to let my viewpoints change because this is my skeptic self going, what kind of arrogant asshole, assholes are pretty great, actually. That's not an insult, right? Arrogant person would assume they've already known everything. Nobody would admit that out loud. You know what I mean? But we do that in our head.
Yeah. But you know, the more you learn, Sophia, the more you realize that you know very little about this world.
Exactly. And that's scary. That's the other thing that I tell people when they're doing this work is they're like, you know, people in my life are going to think I'm crazy. They're not going to want to believe me. And it's the same thing with social justice work. My work is very, I don't believe that it's separate. It's politic, activism, spirituality, health. They're all very interconnected. And social justice work is the same way. Nobody wants to look at their privilege because it's painful. Nobody wants to listen to that voice, honestly, because it's painful. Because one, if you start listening, you realize you've been so mean. I'm the nicest person in the world. You know, people thought I was so nice. And it was like, when I got honest in my head, I was like, I'm so mean. I'm such a mean person. Like, I did one thing wrong and it was 4 days of torture inside me. Like, who wants to admit they're that mean of a person? Nobody. But it sets you free when you admit it. Because once I realized I was that mean, I could begin to change and evolve, you know? And so it's like nobody wants that. Meaning like nobody, like, it's like maybe not nobody, somebody, sure. People that are like sadist or masochistic might enjoy it. And hey, whatever, blessings on them. That's fine. But most of us don't enjoy this process. It's just worth it because the pain that we endure, and that's why it takes a great amount of pain for most people to go through this, is because the pain that we're enduring has to be greater or at least enough pain to motivate sitting in a different kind of pain. If we can hang out in like a neutral zone, most people will hang out in a neutral zone before they admit how much they've hurt. The other thing I had to do is I had to realize that instead of being right, because I was right, and my exes will tell you that after the fact, I was right about a lot of stuff. I was right about a lot of stuff, but I was also wrong. And I was also self-serving, and I was also immature, and I was also passive-aggressive and shut down and controlling, you know? And like, for me to go back and be like, but I was so right and passive-aggressive and controlling was not enjoyable. That is like not fun, you know? It's like not fun. And, but it's really important. So the skeptics, I say, this is my challenge to skeptics, is like, how honest can you get? And when you get that honest, are there spaces that you need? You know, because spirituality isn't the path for everybody. There's great therapy techniques out there. CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, the mindfulness based stress reduction. But you have to be very careful if you're going to go therapeutic route or spiritual routes, because the people that you work with, if they are not comfortable sitting in pain and trauma, they're going to have a hard time leading you through it. Does that make sense? You have to have a practitioner who is going to be confident enough when your shit comes up to not shut it down, because our shit is where we need, that's what we need to go through. That's what we need to get honest about. That's where we can change our patterns, because we're creatures of habit. We're just creatures of habit. We just do what we do until we have to do something else or until we replace it with another thing. And we can hate ourselves for being creatures of habit, it, or we can use that to our advantage and create different habits.
How can you help people to break their habits, Sophia? You see, my last two interviews were with the rape victims. Fortunately for them, they both overcame their trauma. But I'm also aware that there are numerous victims around the world. Lots of them are my listeners. And these people cannot let go of their drama and also find it's impossible to forgive the perpetrators. Is there anything you can say or do to help our listeners?
It's such a beautiful question because it humbles me initially, because many of the people that I work with have already decided that it's possible to change. And that, I think, is the one part that I can't give anyone. The one thing that I offer people is that I did, right? That I cried. I had popped blood vessels in my face. You know, I was, you know, rape and sexual assault has a wide range of kind of overtly hugely violent acts to subtle violent acts, right? And most of the transgressions that happened on me and that actually I did as a teenager were in the subtle area of lack of consent, but there was damage done there. And for me, the one thing that I can tell people is I can offer them my story, my life, which is that there were things that I did, and I talked about this earlier, there are things that I didn't think I could ever recover from that I live with now in a way that I didn't know was possible. And so that's one of the things that I offer, is that I'm saying I didn't always believe it was possible, but I took the risk. I was willing to find out, and that you don't have to know it's possible. You don't have to make healing happen. You just have to be willing to let healing happen. And one of the things that's really true and scary for people is that even with rape and abuse stories, is that healing this process means we have to change, that we will be changed. You can't just heal the rape story and go back to normal, that there's no going back. We can't go back from our traumas, because our traumas become the foundation for our medicine. And if we want to take the medicine, we are changed. That's what medicine does.
Do you think that's the reason why people refuse to change? Because they don't want to lose that identity?
You know, I'm slow to say it because people can get really defensive about that. So it's like if I'm in the room with someone, or like right now, it's like you can hear me like slowing down my voice. Like, this is not accusatory. This is not like, if you could get over yourself, you could change. Like, it's not that. It's subtle. It's difficult. It's scary. It's shared. It's still true for me in my healing. Every time I go to heal something new, I have to make the choice. Am I willing to let everything change? Am I willing to let everything change? I even say, I'm like, please let me stay married. I really love my partner. That would be really great. And I'm willing to even let that go, right? I am willing to let go of everything. I'm willing to be made new, because who I am now has this wound. And I don't know who I'll be without that wound, but I'm willing to find out. So I think it's tricky, but I think the one thing that I'd say is that, you know, I do intravaginal pelvic floor work. I do body work inside the vagina. And many of my clients have experienced sexual assault or rape, and a number of them chronic as children. And
then they also have this phantom pain that, you know, you can't get rid of it.
That's right. Can't get rid of it. Except you can get rid of it. And I've seen that. And that's not something I would ask someone to believe me on, in terms of like, I'm just telling you what I've seen. I've seen people's bodies stop reacting like they're still being raped. And that's what we do. We get stuck. And all of these words, they feel like we get stuck. You know, it's like, you know, honoring the victim part, honoring that we had an innocence that wasn't protected. We get trapped. We get chained to these memories in our body, in our nervous system. Our brain is running the same patterns. Now, here's the thing. If you don't change the pattern, if you don't change a pattern, how you move or navigate in the world, it would be insane for you to not keep thinking it would happen again. I'm going to pull back a little bit from this into a less triggering storyline, but it applies. Okay. So you have a fight with someone, right? And then you think, okay, I forgive them, right? And then you have a fight with them again, and you think, okay, I forgive them. And then you have a fight with them again. You think, okay, I forgive them. Then you have a fight with them again, and your brain goes, I'm not going to fucking forgive them. I'm not going to forgive them. Are you kidding me? Like, no way, right? So that's the smart part. And so every time you get in a conversation, a fight with them, you're like, uh-uh, no way. I know where this is going. I know where this is going. This fight is the same fight. This fight is the same fight. So you never put down your guard.
Yeah.
You never put down your guard because you keep having the same fight. So it's sanity to maintain the protection. And people think the glitching, the tension, the phantom pains, the paranoia is their craziness. It is not your craziness. It is your sanity. You are protecting yourself. Okay. So the first thing you have to do is to recognize that those are the ways, reactive ways to protect yourself. The healing is to say, is there a way that I can integrate what happened, the protection that I took, and the life that I'm living now to create a different way to protect myself? That's the change I'm talking about. It doesn't make sense to put down the defense if you're still in the same fight. So you're talking about changing the whole environment. If you live somewhere, you know, if you lived with someone before that was a domestic partner who was abusive, it made sense to never go to sleep unless they were blackout drunk. But if you divorced them and you live with roommates who are safe, you can go to sleep when they are still awake. But the pattern in the brain would say, I have to wait till everyone else is asleep. So how do you honor the fact that you need to be protected? Okay, I can go to sleep, but I also need to look at how do I track people who are going to be abusive? How do I honor my instincts so that I don't? Because a lot of people after trauma, not always for kids, very different for kids. Kid trauma and adult trauma are related, but different in how you navigate them, because kid trauma is the one place where victim mindset is essential in the healing process. There's a lot of new age or spiritual talk that's like, or a lot of things that people are like, don't be a victim, don't be a victim. That's for adults. That's not for children. Children, especially talking about sexual assault here, children are victims. Somebody was supposed to walk into the room and take you away from the danger. You were a child. That's real. And so the anger and the recognition of that is essential. The next part is to forgive that everybody is human, even adults, children, broken people, and that even though we are supposed to do things as a culture, we fail each other because we're imperfect.
It's interesting when you gave the sleeping example. For over 20 years, I was not able to sleep for more than 10, 20 minutes at a time.
Oh, sweet.
Every time I hear a faintest noise outside my bedroom, I would wake up shivering in cold sweat and was terrified of a particular person would come into my room to hurt me. So I had this constant nightmares about this person. And one day my husband said these exact words to me that changed my life forever. He said, sweetie, you don't have to be afraid of that man. He does not know where you live.
Right.
Even if he did know where you live, he would not be able to come in our house and hurt you.
Right.
And if he did come in our house, I promise you that I won't let him go near you or hurt you. You're safe now. In that moment, I realized I can finally let go of my past and free myself from my own terror.
Right here, yeah.
But you know, Sophia, when you are so wrapped up in your own emotions, you can't think and you can't see clearly.
That's
so really
true.
You need someone to help you see through all this drama and pain. Otherwise, you know, you just live in this space and you become your own bully and terror.
Exactly. Exactly. And the one thing that we know from the kind of monitoring people's brains is that we also see the reality that we believe. So you and I could walk down a street and see, and we could at the end of the street, literally write what was in that street. And you and I could describe almost a different street. And that would be because of the way that we're tracking things. So it's not about then having blind faith. You know what I mean? Like, if you need to put an extra lock on your door, put an extra lock on your door. If you need, you know what I mean? Like, there are certain things that you can do. And if you start to heal and connect that, you can take steps to protect yourself without becoming, without just creating more and more walls, right?
Yeah. Unless someone pointed out to you, you don't have the ability to see through it.
Right. It's very hard to see it for yourself. Very, very hard. The fact that I can see as much as I see for myself is really kind of a freak of nature. And my wife tells me this all the time. She's like, I can't do what you do. Most people can't do what you do. Like that. And I'm like, right. That's true. That's a gift for me. It's, you know, it's a challenge at times. And even so, there are still things that I need someone else to point out at me and say, like, you're doing this thing. Do you know that? And I'm like, oh shit. I totally didn't know that. Like, I totally didn't realize that. It happens all the time. I'm always learning things. Sometimes I notice for myself, I still need someone else and I'm super observant. So this is a flashback to the skeptics conversation too, which is like, get outside feedback, you know, like get, you know, really invite outside feedback to kind of see if there are things that my friend, I have some really good friends, and sometimes we'll sit in the car and we'll say, what do our friends say about me when I'm not in the room? Not so I can be mad at them. You don't have to tell me who it is, but like, what are the observations that people are making about me that they're too scared to tell me? Because it might be helpful for me. And if, again, it's like, you have to be careful, because getting feedback when you're still in bully mode is sometimes not helpful. So you need to take the bully factor is kind of the first part. Then you can start getting feedback, because feedback can be interesting and valuable instead of just like a problem. But I just really appreciate your sharing and that sleeping aspect. And, you know, a lot of what I do some of the work that I do, I do some anger work. I do a workshop called Lions and Dragons sometimes. And one of the things we do is a restraint exercise where we actually hold each other down with consent and rage. That's what we do. And what I do is I'm usually kind of standing over this person, coaching, making sure they're not re-traumatizing themselves, because that's really important, because being cathartic or expressing your emotions does not necessarily mean healing. You can actually re-traumatize. You can go back into a memory and come out and have it and believe it more and be worse. I've done re-traumatizing work myself. And it's, you know, so one of the things that I do is I'm tracking people to make sure what's happening is healing and not re-traumatizing. And I'm mostly tracking breath. I'm tracking, are they breathing all the way through their body, all the way into their pelvic floor? And I'm tracking, are they able to be, this is kind of the key of our conversation in this moment. Are they able to feel the emotions of whatever memory is coming up, but simultaneously feel that they are in the room and in the present moment when that memory is over? It's over. That experience happened. We can't control the future, but the past is over. That part is over. That moment is over, because now you're sitting in a room with five people who you have asked to give you support by giving you resistance. And I'm making sure that they're breathing. I'll make sure they open their eyes. They look at me and I say, it's over. That's over.
Most of our listeners live overseas and cannot attend your workshop in person. Can they do the work with you online, or is there another way for them to work with you?
I do have a blog post where I kind of explain the whole process. Australia, just bring me there. You just get a group of people. I will come to you. I'd be happy to come to you. Really, really, really. I've always wanted to see Australia. I'd be happy. I would love that. And I'm really into skill building, because most of this work is happening moment by moment, breath by breath, you know, washing the dishes, a phone call with your kid, doing yard work. I mean, in the office, in the bathroom at the office, like these are the places where we often get confronted with the moment, that voice, those, you know, those things. And so it's, for me, it's all about skill building, like knowing, having options to reach for. Yeah.
How long does it take for a person to be fully healed from their trauma by working with you, Sophia?
What a sacred, sacred question. For some people, all they need is like a couple of years, really, of reminders. They just need to be reminded for a couple of years, all the things that were like silenced inside them. For other people, it takes 5-7 years. I think most people within 2 years really see their life differently. And after about 5 years are the person they knew they could be.
Oh, it could be much faster. It really depends on the person's desires and willingness to heal themselves, I guess.
Yes, right. Absolutely. And that happens. People wake up and they're like, people do that. They wake up and they literally wake up. They're woke. They like, they have Satori. They have that enlightenment. Now, the thing is, after we wake up, the work begins.
That's when the journey really begins.
So in that way, you know, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha, like, he woke up and then he taught for 40 years, right? Like, and then he learned, he studied for 40 years. So it's like there's an age right now of waking bodhisattvas, of walking bodhisattvas. I am part of that tribe of people that are saying, I am a bodhisattva. We can admit that we are in an age where there are humans who are enlightened, and enlightened doesn't mean perfect. Enlightened means I'm aware that I am both spiritual and human.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me tell you, I had died a few years ago and returned as a brand new person. And my learning journey started from the awakening moment.
Exactly.
And I haven't stopped learning since.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, do we tell people that? Sometimes maybe we just keep it. No, but it is. So that question of how long does it take is like, it takes your lifetime. Question is, it's like, how far do you walk? It's like, Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's a long walk home. And that's everybody's life. It's a long walk home. That's the whole deal.
And the learning process is not about acquiring more information, but it's actually learning to let go of your emotion and also your unhealthy beliefs.
Yep, it is. It's learning to let go. And it's learning to let what is be what is and engage with it. That you don't have to control something to be in relationship with it. And that's letting go, but being engaged. And to me, that's like embodied enlightenment. That's ascending onto the planet. You know, that's bringing all of this awareness into our cultures, as opposed to it was important. We are standing on the prayers and the meditations of the monks and the nuns and the hermits that separated themselves from cultures and witches that prayed and prayed and prayed. And now we're here because of all their prayers. And I'm grateful to them deeply, you know, really, really. And part of our work now, exactly like your podcast, exactly like I have a deck and a book that's skill building. That's, you know, how you do this stuff. And it's like taking this and sharing it and looking to build a culture that embodies these things, right?
Right.
To build a culture that says, you know, our bodies are sacred. Consent is important. Relationships and emotionality are valuable. These are radical statements for our cultures. They're just like totally brand new. Like our planet should be taken care of, not raped. Like this, all of these just across the board. So I think that it's a really, that question of time, how long does it take is a joke. It's a joke question. You know what I mean? Like it's a trick question. It's like,
I expect to hear this answer from you. Glad you didn't let me down.
You know what I always tell people? You know, it's like people always say like, well, how long does this take? Or like, is there another way? Where I'm like, you just have to catch yourself thought by thought, you know, and work on that, you know, is there another way? And I'm like, you better call me the moment you find a faster way. I better be I don't want to find out on Facebook that you found a faster way to enlightenment. You got to call me immediately. I get inside track. If you find a way that takes less work and less pain, you better let me know.
It's a lifetime thing. It will never end.
It's lifetime.
What is time anyway? I don't really pay much attention to it. I don't live in this space. My husband always says to me, I live on a different planet. But to be realistic, Sophia, most of our listeners will want to know how long it would take because they need to know this kind of thing. It's just human nature. I know to me and you, time is irrelevant. But sadly, it applied to a lot of people or to our listeners.
You know, because healing, my favorite, the functionality that I work with, the definition of healing that I work with, sometimes I think I should start the conversations this way, is healing means to become more whole. And so that means we're whole to begin with. We just became more whole. So that never ends. We're just constantly expanding and making that whole. And so that's why it's a lifetime because, you know, I think it takes about 2 years often for people to shift some of those basic habits that we're talking about to be able to start to really change the life that they're living. And that after 5 years of diligent work, that they can really feel like the person they want to be. But there's no healing doesn't end in that. And for some people, you've been doing that work all along. And so that 5 years or, and I always say the universe is constantly expanding. So probably every day, my timelines are shortening. That was how long it took 7 years for me. So I think 5 years is fast, but I think maybe most people now are probably in a more like a three year window. But you know, what is time? What is years? It's like, that's really varies, but I can say that there's a rhythm that we share. It's like time is relative. Time, space is the same thing. They're both expanding. They're bending. They're constant. Like super, super trippy. Like I always talk about how there's like different layers to look at things and how on one layer, there's like no morality. And on another layer, there's like no time, space, you know. And on another level, if you're going to call yourself generous, you have to admit that you're also greedy. Like you can't be generous and then say everything is like, there's no judgment, but I'm generous. I'm like, no. Either there's no judgment or you're generous and you're greedy, but you choose as best you can generosity, right? Like it's like choosing these parallels. You're like mixing paradigms. And I'm like, don't get me wrong. They're constantly being mixed, but I like to watch my language. It's like, what are we? Cause people like to tell me like anger is something we need to transcend. And I'm like, No. Anger is literally some of the most potent and powerful medicine that we need to cultivate and cultivate a relationship with. Not that we have to grow our anger, because the truth is there's plenty of anger there. We just haven't been utilizing it in a constructive way. You know, people use anger for massacres, and people use anger for changing
motivation.
Entire motivation for exactly.
Hey, Sophia, it's really wonderful talking with you. I think we have gone ways over time. I better let you go. Thanks for being on my show.
You're so welcome. I really loved being here, and I wish everyone the best of luck and blessings and joy on their journey.
Have a great day, Sophia.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
Take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you all for listening. That's it for this week. I'll hope to see you again next week. Bye for now.